the letters A, B, and C. So imagine being in a room of 10 people, and you say, okay, so what order do these letters go in? And 10 out of 10 people say, well, A first, then B, then C. Makes sense. Okay, fair enough, you can go along, you know, because everyone has the same understanding of how reality is structured, and that's the right way, and that's good. And okay, and that actually affects language and how it functions, and we use letters as a part of mathematical equations, so it's connected to many different things. 5 years later, you're in a room with 10 people, and you ask that same question again, what are the right order of the letters? And 8 people say A, B, and C, and you're one of them. But 2 people say, no, it's B, C, A. You're like, okay, well, that goes against logic. It goes against what we know. But okay, but still, 8 out of 10 say A, B, and C, so you can still go on functioning according to reality and how the majority understand it. 5 years after that, you're in a room with 10 people, and they ask you, you ask them a question. Okay, these letters A, B, and C, what order do they go in? But this time, the answer that you find is radically different. 4 people say B, C, A. 4 people say C, B, A. And only 2 people, and you're one of them, you're in the minority, say A, B, and C. What in the world is going on? So now you can't really function in the wider world as if it's A, then B, then C. It becomes more difficult because you're in the minority of how things are supposed to be. Now, as I say that, of course, I'm not really talking about letters A, B, and C. I'm talking about priorities. What does A represent? What does B represent? What does C represent? Now, a church father named Augustine, he lived in the late 4th, early 5th century. In book 2 of his Confessions, he makes an argument about the nature of sin, which can be summarized like this. The essence of sin is disordered love. Disordered love. So what does he mean by that? Okay, here's what he means. So we love different things, and so many good things. We love people. We love friends. We love music, a certain idea. We love certain foods. We love certain hobbies, all these sorts of things. We love, hopefully, God. But if we love things in the wrong order, that's what he calls a disordered love, and that's the essence of sin. What if we identify the certain loves that we have, the priorities, the passions, the things that we are excited about, and we identify and start to live by them in our lives in the wrong order? This is, he says, the essence of sin, and I would argue this is a biblical view. So what wisdom does Jesus give us for navigating this when we are sometimes at war within ourselves about how to live by the right ordering of loves and how, as we live in a world which has many different answers about the ordering of loves? What wisdom does Jesus have for us? And so let's open our Bibles to Mark 12, and we're beginning at verse 1. And this is a part of our journey through the Gospel of Mark line by line. And one of the things you've noticed is that there's increasing tension. There's tension all the time. It's mounting. It comes in different ways. And today, Jesus is responding to challenges from the official leadership in and around Jerusalem. And he, Jesus, began to teach them to them in parables. Now, who's them? So if you trace it back to verse 27, this is the chief priests, scribes, and elders. These are established leaders. A man planted a vineyard, he says, and put a fence around it and dug a pit for the wine press and built a tower. This is like a lookout tower. And leased it to tenants and went into another country. So this is a scenario that everyone would have been familiar with. So there's a person, a landowner, they've got money, they set up this wine press, they have tenants to come in and to work the property, and they share in some of the fruit of it. And so that was a standard setup that people would have been familiar with. Verse 2, when the season came, he sent a servant to the tenants to get from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. Makes sense, that's normal. Verse 3, and they took him and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. Business is not going well. Again, he sent to them another servant, and they struck him on the head and treated him shamefully. Business is really not going well. And he sent another, and they killed him. And so with many others, some they beat, some they killed. Not good. He had still one other, a beloved son. Finally, he sent him to them, saying, they will respect my son. Now, when Jesus tells a parable, and you'll know this as you try to study them over the years, you're trying to figure, okay, what goes with what? Who does who represent in the story? And so all of a sudden, when you come across a character who's named as the son, the beloved son, you think, maybe this is Jesus. After all, he is the son of God. And I think that is what we're supposed to see. And there's actually a clue in the text. So it calls him the beloved. And that's the exact same word in Greek. Way back in chapter 1, that was used to describe Jesus at his baptism Exact same word used to describe Jesus at the Transfiguration in Mark 9. So this is Christ. That's who he represents. Verse 7, but those tenants said to one another, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. And they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. So if Jesus is arguing against the official religious establishment who is opposed to him, who do these people represent? Who are the people who take and kill him? This is the people that Jesus is speaking the parable to. What will the owner of the vineyard do? Well, we can presume that the owner of the vineyard is our Heavenly Father. He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others. And then in verse 10, Jesus provides this commentary. Have you not read this scripture? And here he quotes from Psalm 118. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. So imagine ancient builders, they're there, and they're choosing what rocks to use, and some of them will say, well, this rock isn't good for the building. We're going to throw it out. And Jesus says, you're throwing it out, but this is actually the cornerstone. This is Christ himself. He is the very foundation of the promises of God, the very foundation of the people of God. Verse 12, and they were seeking to arrest him, but feared the people, for they perceived that he had told the parable against them. True. So they left him and went away. Verse 13, and they sent to him some of the Pharisees and some of the Herodians to trap him in his talk. So the Pharisees we've met before, the Herodians are people who are loyal to King Herod, right? Herodians. And then they're there specifically to trap him, we're told. And they came and said to him, teacher, we know that you are true and do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances, but truly teach the way of God. Do you think they believe that? They're buttering him up, right? We know that they're here to trap him. We know later that Jesus knows their hypocrisy, so they're buttering him up. Here's the question. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay them or should we not? Now, at this point, we need to notice a few things. So this is a poll tax that would have been due from adult males. Should we pay them to Caesar? So who is Caesar? Caesar is the Roman emperor, and at this time in history, it's a person named Tiberius. And Jews are living in the land, and they're living under a harsh Roman oppression. There's big taxes. The Romans are often violent. Many Jews feel like prisoners in their own land. Okay, so this is a very controversial question. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And so this day, we're very removed from this, and we're like, this doesn't seem like that much of a hot-button issue. But at the time, it was a hot-button issue. You know, if you're in a social gathering and you go in and you bring up certain topics, the temperature of the room immediately rises. You know what those topics are? Let's talk about politics for a second. Let's talk about sexual ideology. Let's talk about vaccines. Let's talk about war. Like all these things. Certain topics just immediately raise the temperature. This was one of those topics in that day. Should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? And so Jesus is put in a bit of an interesting situation. But knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, why put me to the test? Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. Okay, so a couple of things. First of all, a denarius is the tax, is the coin that you needed to use to pay the tax. You couldn't use other coinage. You needed to use the denarius. So it's worth about $150. So here's the thing with this. In the graphics above, I've put a picture of it. And so you can see on the one side, there's a picture of Caesar, of Tiberius. But on the other side, there's an abbreviation of a phrase indicating that Caesar is the son of divine Augustus, meaning it claims that he is divine. He is a son of the gods. And so this is very controversial, partly because of what the coin says. So there were actually revolts after the time of Jesus and before the time of Jesus about this very thing. In fact, devout Jews were in this kind of argument back and forth. Is it sacrilegious to even have one of these coins? Why? Because they're to worship the one God of Israel, the God of the Bible. This is monotheism. They're not to have graven images. If you've got an image which is carved, which claims to be divine, should you be holding on to that? Probably not. Right? And so imagine in our own time how you would feel if our own current national leader put out a coin. You have to pay an excessive tax with this coin. It's got his own face on it. And below the inscription says, a son of the gods. Would you want to use that coin? I wouldn't. And so this is very, very controversial at the time. But notice something else that Jesus does. He's so such a genius. If there's a debate around whether or not it's sacrilegious to hold the coin, and they've said, hey, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? By asking them for it, he forces them to produce one. They're actually carrying it. They're actually holding it. They're questioning his own purity, but they're carrying the denarius. And they brought one, and he said to them, whose likeness and inscription is this? They said to him, Caesar's. And Jesus said to them, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And they marveled at him. Now, what's interesting here is the word for likeness, whose likeness is on the coin. It's the same word in the Greek version of Genesis 1 for creation. So we are created in the likeness or image of God. So the same word is used, and I think we are supposed to see a connection here. So, okay, that coin has the likeness of Caesar, so give it to him, but you are made in the likeness of God, so you owe your life to God. So he's, I think, consciously making a contrast. Continuing, verse 18, and Sadducees came to him. See, the waves of challenge keep coming. The Sadducees came to him who say there is no resurrection, and they asked him a question. Now, Pharisees, we know, Herodians, Sadducees, they're another group of religious leaders. They don't believe in the resurrection of people at the end of time. They also don't believe in angels, but that's a question for another day. Saying, verse 19, teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife, but leaves no child, the man must take the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. Now, they're going to play out a little scenario to test Jesus and his knowledge of the nature of God and of the scriptures. Now, this is specifically a practice called a Levirate marriage, and you can read about it in Deuteronomy 25. And so we might think this is strange by today's standards because we think really of marriage fundamentally as a romantic endeavor, but it was much more in the ancient world, and it should be more than that today. But the idea is actually compassionate in nature. So there's not all the social safety nets that there are and support systems that there are today in the ancient world. And so this is actually so that the woman is cared for and provided for, and also so that the family name lives on. It's a really interesting section of text, actually. If the person doesn't want to do this, the woman has the right to go to the elders and spit in the guy's face. Man, there's so much interesting stuff in the Bible. You just check it out. It's wild. Anyway, verse 20, there were seven brothers, and the first took a wife, and then he died and left no offspring, so no kids. The second took her and died, leaving no offspring, and the third likewise, and the seven left no offspring. Last of all, the woman also died in the resurrection when they rise again. Whose wife will she be? For the seven had her as wife. Jesus said to them, is this not the reason you are wrong? Because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And so Jesus responds first by saying that they've misunderstood the nature of marriage, that there will be marriage in heaven when there won't be. And so we all need to realize and remember that most, well, we will all be single for the vast majority of our existence when you consider the timeline of horizon, including heaven, because marriage is a temporary human institution. And so that doesn't last into heaven. And I remember I was talking with a man who said, he was towards the end of his life. This was years ago, and his wife had passed away. And he said to me, you know, I know there's no marriage in heaven, but when I get there, I hope the Lord will let me hold her hand for a while. And I said, well, the Lord is gracious and merciful. I'm sure he will. There's consciousness. We will know one another, all that sort of stuff. But marriage is a temporary institution. And so Jesus says that you've gotten it all wrong and you have misunderstood the nature of heaven. And as for the dead being raised, have you not read in the book of Moses in the passage about the bush? So here he references Exodus 3, how God spoke to him saying, I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He's not God of the dead, but of the living. You are quite wrong. So he's saying that God is God of the living, and so even though Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have passed away, God is still their God because they're with him in heaven. So his response seems not totally connected to the original question, but I think Jesus is here redirecting them out of this vain speculation back into a focus on the fact that God is alive, he is living, and he summons us to serve him in the here and now. And so we end our look at the text for today there. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
So there's three stories here, and they're connected in the following ways. First of all, hostile leadership is confronting Jesus. Second, Jesus outsmarts them. Third, he does so by showing them the priority of God and the priority that God should have in our lives, and then how the scriptures accurately show how God should have priority in our lives. And all of this is encapsulated in the statement that Jesus gives so brilliantly in verse 17, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And then what our focus is going to be today is we're going to think through, are we actually living like this? Are we living that principle out in our day-to-day lives? Now, some of you might say, okay, well, we're not governed by Caesar. We're not living under the Roman imperial system. What do you mean? And so as Christians historically have looked at this passage, they have tried to apply it in a couple of different ways, and they think, okay, yeah, should we pay taxes? There's biblical justification for that. Should we respect and pray for our leaders, including political leaders, even when we disagree with them? Yes, there's biblical precedent for that. But the principle that Jesus here teaches, can be applied in broader ways as well. So we're going to relook at that statement from Augustine. The essence of sin is disordered love. And this is partly what Jesus is teaching here. Okay, the things that you care about, the things that you love, the things that you seek after in your life, are they ordered correctly? Are you giving to God the things that are God's, and to Caesar the things that are Caesar's? Now, there's irony here, because these people who are trying to trap Jesus, saying, hey, are you going to show greater allegiance to Caesar or to God, are the people who, in the end, get caught for doing that same thing themselves in their own hypocrisy. So how do we know this? Well, the various different groups who are opposed to Jesus, they kind of have this strange, dark unity the closer we get to the crucifixion, because they come together on a united front against a common enemy who is Jesus. And what do we read at the trial before Pilate in John 19:15? "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." Turns out that their love was in fact disordered when they were trying to accuse Jesus of the same thing. And so what we're going to do to try to apply this to our own lives, we're going to put a blank in there where the word Caesar had been. Render to blank the things that are blanks, and to God the things that are God's. And so let's say that A represents God. Let's say B represents family. Let's say C represents something else, maybe work, maybe a hobby. Are we ordering things rightly? Family is important. Is it above God? No. Work is important. It can be, certainly, when we are working. Is it above family? No. Is it above God? No. So we need to work at the ordering of our loves. Augustine said, the essence of sin is disordered love. And so as we try to live this out, however we're going to, like, I put ABC, but there's so many more things. As we try to live that out, we have to recognize that there's a struggle and a battle going on at least two fronts. And the first is internal. There is an internal civil war going on within each of us as we try to live out these priorities and as we try to order our loves. In the book of James, chapter 4, verse 1, it said like this, "Are not your passions at war within you?" Your passions, your desires, the things that you love, the things that you crave after. There's an internal civil war as we try to live this out. Is it BCA? Is it CBA? Is it ABC? And so we're struggling with that internally. Secondly, the second battle is in the midst of the culture around us. Remember at the start I said 10 people, and you know that the answers people gave kept changing as you went on through the years. That's the situation in which we find ourselves. So you go ask people, hey, what's the right ordering of loves? People are going to give you a whole bunch of different answers. And so a couple of verses later, James says, "Do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God?" So friendship with the world, when you are friendly and cuddle up with and become harmonious with the values of the dominant culture, which are anti-God, that's hostility toward God. So not only is there this internal civil war as we try to work out the ordering of loves, but we're struggling with it in the society around us. So let me make a few suggestions as to the kind of things we would put where that blank is, and I ask you to kind of do some self-evaluation as I do so. First, the family. Render to the family the things that are the family's, and to God the things that are God. Family is good. We love family. We support one another, we learn from one another, we teach one another, we listen, we seek to understand, but the family is not God. You hear people say family first? No, that's idolatry. When we actually put our family above God, what we're actually doing is bringing more harm into their lives, not less. Work. Render to the workplace the things that are the workplace, but to God the things that are God. Work can be good. We sweat, we contribute, we make a difference, hopefully. We maybe make friends and colleagues and coworkers sometimes. But if that bumps up the list too far, we are disordering our loves. School's important. We learn, we grow, but don't let it take over. When it takes over, we are engaging in a kind of disordering of loves. Render to the school the things that are the school's, but to God the things that are God's. Friends, they're important. We support, we laugh, we cry, but don't let friends take the place of God. Render to friendship the things that are due to friendship, but to God the things that are God's. Sports. Sports are fun, we learn life lessons, we stay in shape, we compete, but don't let them take over what rightly belongs to the Lord. Render to the arena, the soccer field, the dance studio, the things that are those things, but to God the things that are God's. Money. It can be good, it buys groceries, it pays the soccer registration, it pays for a lot of gasoline in the generator. It's good. But don't let money compete with God in the chamber of your heart. Professor Kent Dunnington recalls a story that he heard from a paramedic, and the paramedic was called in to help somebody, and he went into this room, and this is this horrible scene, and he finds a man inches from his own life in the corner, and he's huddled in there. There's drug paraphernalia everywhere, and this is the only thing that this guy has become focused on. He's so near death. And this is what the paramedic says: for the first time in my life, I know what true worship looks like. To be so dedicated, to be so devoted to something that all other things, even good things, just fade away in importance. And I'm not saying that we are necessarily like this, but what I am saying is the loves, the passions, the desires that we have, whatever they happen to be, can compete for first place in your life against God. When we leave them unchecked, things that can even seem good at first can take us in a wrong direction and consume more and more of us to the detriment of other things, including God. So Augustine said, the essence of sin is disordered love. What in your life has become disordered? What in your life has become disordered? Make sure you give to God the things that are God's. Amen.